And in the name of the board, I would like to welcome you to our second panel of the semester, What's Next? Egypt, its revolution and its implication for the region. The panel was put together last week as the Egyptian upheavals began, and a week later the situation has deteriorated and more questions arise. Is reform possible in Egypt? And if so, is El Baradei the man to lead it? Can we determine a clean divide between a moderate pro-American camp and an extremist militant axis? What will happen to the relationship with Cairo and Washington? Is this Tehran 1979 or Berlin 1989? What is next? I want to especially thank our professors with us today. They immediately agreed to participate in this event and have worked with us to make rapid progression in the organization of the panel. Their willingness to share their knowledge with the students embodies the outstanding faculty-student relationship we have at Cornell. I look forward to their insights and opinions. First to speak is Professor Fahmi, assistant professor of modern Middle East history, whose interests include nationalism in the modern Middle East, colloquial Arabic mass culture, and media and identity in Egypt and the Arab world. His dissertation, Popularizing Egyptian Nationalism, was awarded the Malcolm Kerr Dissertation Award, and his book, Ordinary Egyptians, Creating the Modern Nation Through Popular Culture, is forthcoming. Professor Fahmi will assess the Mubarak regime and analyze the grievances against it expressed by its people. Professor David Patel will focus on the unfolding of the protest. Professor Patel is an assistant professor in the government department and teaches comparative politics with a focus on the Middle Eastern politics, Islamic institutions, and political cultures. Instead of analyzing Islam as shared values or ideology, Professor Patel combines game theory and ethnography to examine how Islamic institutions and symbols can provide individuals information that facilitates powerful political coordination and enhances social solidarity. Last but not least, Valerie Bunce is the Aaron Binnenkrob Professor of International Studies and Professor of Government. Her research and teaching addresses comparative democratization, international democracy promotion, primarily in the U.S., by the U.S., and inter-ethnic cooperation and conflict. Today, Professor Bunce will talk about the diffusion of the unrest from Tunisia, as well as elaborate on the lessons from other waves of mobilizations against dictatorship. Finally, I would like to recognize the work of our board, who has proven once again that teamwork and determination, coupled with a little extra effort, can transform our ideas into concrete realities. This semester is rich in ideas and projects for the Cornell International Affairs Review. After the positive feedback from our weekly newsletter started last year, we have successfully launched our blog, thediplomacist.org, where students from across the nation share their insights on the events shaping our world. In just the first week, we received over 1,600 single visitors. Last week, we held an engaging panel on NATO's commitment to Afghanistan, and we have been working on upcoming events for this semester on themes ranging from the conduct of diplomacy in the WikiLeaks era and the role of media for the student movements in the Middle East to the politics of environmental policies. We aim to forge a diverse network of engaged students who, as citizens, share an interest in foreign policy. We hope and we believe that our initiatives contribute to the intellectual vibrancy of our campus. Thank you for participating in this adventure, and please join me in welcoming Professor Bunce, Fahmi, and Professor Patel. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming, and I see it's a full house, and I'm definitely very happy about this, and I'm sure most of you have a lot of questions. The way we're going to set up the presentations, we sort of just huddled right before, is that they're going to be very brief. My presentation probably around 10 minutes, and I want to show an important video right after that, and that's about a 4-minute video, so total will be around 15 minutes or so. And then after we all go, we'll open it up for questions, and I'm sure you have many of those. What I wanted to present on today, at least as sort of an introduction to what is really happening in Egypt today. For most of you, about a month ago, if I were to ask you about Egypt or the Mubarak regime, you probably would have more of sort of a regular, almost a positive look. Yes, it's an ally. The Egyptian regime is an ally of the United States. It seems to be stable. It never really is covered in the media with any critical lens whatsoever, at least in mainstream media, unless you were examining what's happening in Egypt more closely. You wouldn't really come to that realization. I know this because when I teach my classes on modern Egyptian history, when I get to cover the Mubarak regime critically, the students are typically shocked that, yes, it is a dictatorship. Joe Biden just realized that eventually, but even he wasn't really aware that that was the case. So I want to get to why did the Egyptian demonstrators come out in full force, and why the strong emotion that most of you can see in the streets and on the television cameras. Typically, when I go to Egypt, I always take taxi rides either in Cairo or Alexandria. One of the first things I do, and I always do, is have discussions with the cab drivers, and almost immediately the grievances come out. And they realize sort of that I'm Egyptian American. I'm talking to them in colloquial Egyptian, so they're a little bit comfortable, and then they start talking. And typically, it's obviously about not having enough to survive, not having enough to live. Again, half of the Egyptian population survives and lives on around $60 a month. Cab drivers make more than that, but not much more. And it's the daily grind, and it's the daily interaction with the Egyptian police. The Egyptian government, just small tasks like getting a driver's license or getting a taxi cab license involves a great deal of bribery and on all levels. Just cab drivers driving in the streets, and sometimes when I'm with them in the taxi cab, if they're stopped by a traffic officer, for example, they're almost expected to give $1 or $2 as a bribe, or else they might give them a ticket. Just to get your kids into the public school system, which is pretty horrific to begin with, but to do that, there's a lot of also bribery involved in that. To get your driver's license and so on and so forth. And so these are some of the small grievances that truly add up. In addition to that, police torture is endemic, and it's not just political activists that are tortured. It is everyday people. When, for example, if something happened to be stolen and you report it to the police, regular police procedure is to typically round up the usual suspects in that particular area and torture them, all of them. If it happened to be 30 people, all 30 will be tortured until one of them confesses. Almost everyone, especially people who are working class Egyptians, really, know someone or a relative that's been tortured by the police, and in some way or another, there's always this typically negative interaction. Of course, there's political repression as well, people are not allowed really to express their political views openly. Demonstrations are essentially outlawed, and when they do happen, of course before those events, but when they do happen, they're typically limited to a very small location and to a few hundred demonstrators, and they're typically the hardcore activists that are demonstrating. And often, if it reaches beyond a couple of hundred or so, then the secret police comes in with their thugs and arrests them and so on and so forth. To give you another picture of all of this, the internal security apparatus in Egypt overall, that's including the secret police, the riot police, intelligence services, and so on and so forth. Numbers close to 1.5 million in a country of over 80 million. The Egyptian army is 500,000. So that gives you a sense of what's happening here. Just walking in the streets of Cairo back last fall, I was there in the fall, almost every few meters as you're walking, you will see a uniformed guard or police officer. And then you also have undercover officers everywhere. Now I want to give you sort of a very quick summary of the events in the last 3 years. There are several events that took place that contributed to what's happening now. And those events help mobilize what we hear about as far as the Facebook revolution. And this is what led some of those tech-savvy, middle-class, most of them are 20-something in their 20s and 30s, really, to begin to be more politically active. The first event, which you might hear about sometimes now in the media, but at least the periphery of it, was a strike that took place 3 years ago in 2008, in April 6, 2008. And that strike was actually in a small town in the delta of Egypt called El Mahalla El Kobra, or El Mahalla for short. And it's an industrial town that essentially has dozens of textile factories. And the workers there are very underpaid, as I mentioned. They're politically active, and they do have a small labor movement. And they essentially attempted to start a strike on April 6th. The crackdown on that strike was fairly brutal, and it ended fairly quickly. But word got out. Why? Because nowadays, of course, almost everyone is a journalist, because there's millions of cell phones in Egypt, and most of them have cell phone cameras, video cameras, as well as still photographs. And so the events were covered pretty widely. And capitalizing on this were these group of young activists who are bloggers and so on and so forth, either on Facebook or on their own blogs. And they started a movement called the April 6th Movement. And it was around this time. What they tried to do unsuccessfully was to nationalize those events. Word spread fairly quickly, but it never led to people actually moving to the streets in Cairo and Alexandria and elsewhere. What they did was they attempted to create a day of mourning every April 6th to have people strike and get into the streets. The secret police was on top of it. They cracked down on it. So on April 6, 2009 and 2010, there were some protesters, but they were essentially snuffed. But nonetheless, they set up a Facebook page, and they were organized, and they were trying to build some coalition with the Egyptian labor movement as well. Another important event that highlighted the police brutality that I just talked about was an event that took place last summer, with the death of an upper middle class Egyptian man, 28 years old, and essentially he was beat to death by the Egyptian police. The police attempted to cover it up, and they essentially said, he was being arrested and swallowed a small bag of marijuana, and it was stuck in his throat, and he suffocated. The family, of course, was suspicious, and they sent someone to the morgue, and they took pictures. You're lucky that I spared you some of those pictures, but they're out there, and you can find them. And that sparked the We Are All Khaled Said Facebook site, which began to really mobilize more and more everyday Egyptians in seeing in front of their eyes the brutality. And that's the group that was started by Wael Ghunaim, who's the Google executive that was arrested 2 days after the demonstration started and was just released recently. I'll answer some of your questions afterwards regarding that particular case. So in essence, just to conclude, those two groups contributed tremendously to what was happening at the time. And after the Tunisian revolts, after those revolts took place, many of those bloggers, who number in the thousands, began to call for a new day of, in a sense, mourning, and a day for wanting to have change in the country on the Tunisian model. And they picked Police Day, January 25th, ironically. Most people thought that maybe this will really amount to nothing, because they attempted to do this before on April 6th and so forth. Some people, of course, suspected that maybe you'll have a bigger gathering because of what happened in Tunisia. And the rest is history. Now I think I want to stop to show you that clip, if I can get my computer going again. This clip is essentially one of those bloggers, young Egyptian activist that was calling on people to get out, and you can see in her voice, it is subtitled, you can see hear in her voice the sense of desperation. She almost doesn't believe that this is going to really happen, but this was one of the critical videos that came out that actually mobilized the people to get out there into the streets, and then the ball started rolling downhill after that. I think, yeah, because of the subtitles. Hopefully.
أو يمكن يحصل حصل في تونس يمكن نبقى بلد حرة، بلد فيها عدل، بلد فيها كرامة، بلد الإنسان فيها إنسان بجد، مش عايش كحيوان. النهاردة واحد منهم مات وأعلن موته، بقيت كل الناس واقفة تقول لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله، ده مات كافر، ده مات عايز شهرة. يا جماعة حرام عليكم. أنا نزلت وكتبت إن أنا بنت وهنزل ميدان التحرير وهقف لوحدي وهرفع يافطة يمكن الناس تحس، وكتبت رقم يمكن الناس تنزل. محدش نزل إلا ثلاث شباب، محدش نزل إلا ثلاث شباب وثلاث عربيات أمن مركزي، وكان الباقي جاي في السكة، وعشرات من البلطجية وظباط، وكانوا جايين بمنتهى الرعب. فضلوا يتكلموا معانا، بعدونا عن الناس يمكن بأسوأ شوية، بس أول لما انفردوا بينا قعدوا يقولوا حرام عليك كفاية، إحنا منكم، إحنا من الشعب. الناس اللي عندهم دول عندهم حالة نفسية، حالة نفسية حرام بقى، كفاية اللي بيحصل ده، كفاية كل الجرائد وكل حاجة تبع الحكومة. أي حد بيموت من البهدلة والقرف اللي إحنا عايشين فيه يتقال إن هو مات كده علشان عنده اختلال ولا مشكلة نفسية. مشكلة نفسية روح عند مجلس الشعب. أنا بس بصور لكم فيديو عشان أقول لكم رسالة واحدة، عايزين ننزل يوم 25، لو لسه عندنا كرامة ولسه عايزين نعيش كإنسان وكبني آدمين في البلد دي لازم ننزل يوم 25. هننزل نطالب بحقنا، بحقنا كبني آدمين، مش هقول لكم حقنا كسياسيين ولا عايزين ولا أهل الشعب ولا رئيس ولا أي زفت من الكلام ده كله، عايزين حقنا، مش عايزين أي حاجة تانية. الحكومة دي كلها بقت بايظة، رئيس فاسد والدنيا بايظة وأمن دولة بايظ. الناس دي خافوا من، ما خافوش من الموت وخافوا من أمن الدولة، خافوا من الفساد. تخيلوا انتوا برضه انتوا كده هتموتوا نفسكم ولا انتوا مش دارين؟ انا هنزل يوم 25، من دلوقتي لحد 25 هنزل اوزع بيان على كل واحد في الشارع، ومش هولع في نفسي. لو الحكومه عايزه تولع فيا تيجي تولع، وكل واحد في البلد دي شايف نفسه راجل يبدا ينزل. ما كل واحد في البلد دي بيقول البنات اللي بتنزل مظاهره بتتبهدل وما يصحش ان هي تنزل، وحرام يخلي عنده نكوه ورجوله وينزل يوم 25. كل واحد بيقول العدد هيبقى نازل قليل ومفيش حاجه هتحصل، عايز اقول له انت السبب اللي احنا فيه. ايوه انت السبب، وانت مدان زيك زي الرئيس، زي اي فاسد، زي اي ظابط بيظهرنا وبيبهدلنا. انت السبب. نزولك معانا هيفرق، ومش بيفرق حاجه بسيطه، لا بيفرق كتير. كلامك مع جيرانك ومع صحابك ومع زمايلك ومع اهلك، وانك تشجعهم ان هم ينزلوا حتى لو بينزلوا في منطقه مش في ميدان التحرير ولا قدام اللاذقية ولا في اي حته، بس تنزلوا تسجلوا موقف وتقولوا احنا بني ادمين، ده بيفرق. وقعدك في بيتك بتتفرج او بتشوف على الفيسبوك وبتطلع على الاخبار، ده بيبهدلنا احنا، بيبهدلنا انا. لو انت عندك كرامه وانت انسان وراجل في البلد دي يبقى تنزل، تنزل تحميني وتحمي اي بنت تانيه. لو فضلت قاعد في البيت تبقى تستحق كل اللي بيجرى، ومش انت لوحدك، انت هتبقى مدان، انت هتبقى مسؤول، وانت اللي عليك ذنب كبير قوي، ذنب البلد دي وذنب كل واحد عايش فيها. انت هتبقى شايل مسؤوليه كل واحد نزل الشارع عشان يطالب بحقه وانت قاعد في بيتك. انزل البيت، ابعت مسجات لاصحابك، اكتب على النت في كل حته، وعي. انت عارف الدايره بتاعتك، عمرك لوحدها واصحابك وقرايبك، بس قول لهم انزل معايا، نزلهم 5 ولا 10، وكل واحد فينا نزل 5 و10 ونزل بيهم لميدان التحرير او ميدان اللاذقية او في اي حته عشوائيه حتى، ويتكلم الناس ويقول لهم بقى كفايه، بدل ما نولع في نفسنا تعالوا نتكلم ونسجل موقف. ده هيفرق، وهيفرق كتير قوي. اوعى تقول مفيش امل، طول ما انت بتقول مفيش امل هيبقى مفيش امل، طول ما انت بتنزل وبتسجل موقف هيبقى في امل. اوعى تخاف من الحكومه، خاف من ربنا. ربنا بيقول ان الله لا يغير ما بنفسا حتى بقوما حتى يغيروا ما بانفسهم. ليه؟ مش علشان ان انت تبقى كويس وقاعد في حالك وماشي من بركتك، الحيطة هتقع عليك وهتقع علينا كلنا. انزل وطالب بحقك وبحقي وبحق اهلك وبحقنا كلنا. انا نازلة يوم 25 وهقول للفساد لا والنظام لا.
So if you have questions on this, it'll be after the rest of the speakers. So thank you. So I can't get my computer working, so I'm gonna change strategies here and talk about some different things. So green fever is sweeping America and Israel too. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about the green fever, which isn't Packer fans. It's fear of the Muslim Brotherhood taking over. So we'll talk a little bit about the Muslim Brothers, put them in context of the opposition, talk about the likelihood of them coming to power,
And what I'm going to argue is it's really hard to know how support for the Brotherhood under authoritarianism is going to translate into support for the Muslim Brothers in a democratic Egypt, and how the fear of them coming to power has been vastly overplayed, and why. I'm going to talk a little bit about Omar Suleiman, who's now the vice president and the president in I would say, de facto president of Egypt. He's not a Democrat. He doesn't believe in democracy for Egypt, and he's an SOB. But he's America's SOB, and he's Israel's SOB. So if you think that's important to have an SOB there who we like, he's your guy. Finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about the protesters' demands, what we know about them, and argue that basically nothing has been achieved so far. Anderson Cooper's gone home. Christiane Amanpour has gone off to some other exotic locale. But the story, we're still at day one, and this is now existential for the people there in the square. Okay, so the Muslim Brothers are one of many opposition groups are there. Yes, they're the best organized and probably the largest group in Egypt right now, but they're one of many protester groups that are out there. They weren't on the front lines of this. They gradually came in individually, and now institutionally they've gone all in. They're backing Mohamed El-Baradei, who doesn't have much of a base of support in Egypt. He has a nascent party. We like him, right? He's very eloquent. He speaks fluent English. He has a Nobel Prize, which some of us care about. And he's been put up in many ways as a spokesman. And he's tried to put himself up as the spokesman of the protesters. There was this dramatic scene a couple days ago of him going down to Tahrir and giving a speech. Well, he hasn't been back there. There's a reason, right? He hasn't been able to mobilize all of the different groups behind him. There's a lot of youth movements. We mentioned the April 6th movement. We heard of the Kafaya movement. There's a number of other parties. Tagama, the Waft, there's a number of groups of wise men who are participating, and some of them are secular, some of them are liberal, some of them are pretty conservative nationalist. Not all the secular groups are pro-American or pro-Israel. In fact, some of the strongest statements against American and Israeli involvement have come from some of the Kafaya movement. Some of the Kafaya movement leaders have said that they're explicitly anti-American interference in Egyptian affairs. So don't think that it's the Muslim Brothers versus all the other opposition groups who are going to basically be pro-American. So who are the Muslim Brothers? Are they a terrorist organization, a radical organization? One of the challenges of talking about the Muslim Brothers is the views you get tend to be extremely polarized. There's people who want to tell you that they're the next coming of Hitler, that they're horrible, that they're dangerous, and that anything must be done to prevent them from having even a chance at power. Other people say, no, they're Christian Democrats, they're the Muslim version of Christian Democrats, don't worry about them whatsoever. We can talk a little bit about that in the Q&A. I'll provide a little bit of a background. The Muslim Brothers were founded in 1928 by Hassan al-Banna, who wanted to return not just Egyptian society, but Muslim society back to some values. They wanted to reform society, starting with individuals, get individuals to return back to what he understood to be the principles of Islam, to the values of Islam, the traditions of Islam, the morals of Islam. And individuals, having reformed themselves, will go out and reform others. Gradually, society will be reformed, and the Muslim community will be able to achieve the great things that it did, especially holding off imperialism and foreign aggression. Wasn't a return to anything. He's based very much on Western forms of organization. He's not a cleric by any stretch of the imagination. Anyone know what the motto of the Muslim Brothers is? Islam is the solution dates from the 1980s. Huh? Be prepared, right? He got it from the Boy Scouts. I'm serious. He was in the United States, he learned it from the Boy Scouts, and he came back and modeled the youth wing, the Rovers, which some people now claim is the terrorist wing of the Muslim Brothers, off the U.S. Boy Scouts. He brought back ways of organizing from his studies. It was Columbia University, I think? Yeah, where he brought back some ideas of how you organize, create hierarchical administrations. So it's not a traditional organization in that sense that's indigenous in any way. They did have a militant wing, a small group called the Special Apparatus. We know it was pretty active in the late 1940s. All the evidence we have is that it completely disappeared and was shut down about 1954. So they don't have a military wing and haven't had a military wing for decades. And I'll talk a little bit about their relationship to some radicals in a second. They don't have a military wing. some of people involved in their youth organization had like a martial arts exhibition a few years ago, and everyone started waving their hands. Like a Boy Scout group having an MMA? An MMA exhibition or something. But it was blown out of proportion because people want to say that they're a threat. So they're involved in terrorist activities throughout the 40s against the British, assassinate the Prime Minister of Egypt in 48. Hassan al-Banna himself is assassinated in a counter-assassination in 1949, and the Brotherhood is left in disarray. The main leader, the founder's gone. They support the revolution, the Free Officers' Revolution in 52, and they saw themselves as the ideologues of this new regime that was coming about. They were very quickly disillusioned by that and realized they weren't going to be, and went underground and were basically crushed from 54 on. So they're an organization that's been illegal, underground, in hiding in many ways, although you know where they are, you can find them, for the past six decades. Okay. Since then, they've had a lot of splits. A lot of people disagreed with the Muslim Brothers who've participated in elections over the time, who haven't tried to overthrow the government since the 50s. And so you've had lots of Islamists break away from them, right? The Islamic group, Islamic Jihad, are the two best known groups who disagreed with the participation of the Muslim Brothers in any sort of governmental system which did not base itself on what they understood to be God's law. So they had that early organizational link to radical groups who broke away from them and split with them and now have nothing to do with them. And I'll talk about those groups because they come back in the narrative when I talk about our SOB, Omar Suleiman. Okay, so the Muslim Brothers have participated in elections in the past couple decades. They have a lot, people say they have 15 to 20% of the Egyptian population on their side. We have no clue, right? Why? It's an authoritarian regime. That 15 to 20% is based on how they did, not in the last election where they won one seat under a really corrupt election, which really wasn't fair. All countries in the Middle East, except for one, have elections of some sort, right? Even Saddam Hussein was elected. Guess what's the one country in the Middle East that doesn't have elections at any level, national, municipal, no level? Wrong. I'll give you a hint. The leader of this country came to power when he overthrew his father in a coup. Your university has a campus in this country, and you guys don't know. I'm really disappointing you guys. So the Muslim Brothers have participated in elections over, talk about biting the hand that feeds you. The Muslim Brothers have participated in elections. They got 15 to 20% of the vote, approximately. The electoral system in Egypt's very odd, two elections ago. But the thing is, what do we know about support for the Muslim Brothers? The people who support them aren't the rural poor. The people who support them are you guys, sometimes quite literally, university students. They're very popular among the quote-unquote most modern members of society, pharmacists, engineers, lawyers, doctors. They won the elections in the Professional Association of the Engineers in 1987. They won a majority in the doctors in 1990. So it's among that group of people who were educated in the 80s, in the late 70s, early 80s, and see the opportunity for advancement and see this incredibly corrupt system that isn't allowing them to achieve what they want to be able to achieve in terms of quality of life. So they've turned to the Muslim Brothers because a couple reasons. The Muslim Brothers were seen as the only viable opposition group under Mubarak. The Muslim Brothers have provided services to middle-class individuals, health clinics, schools, training centers throughout the country. We know those social services are very popular. Some people say the message that they bring, that it's a corrupt system that needs to be reformed, fits with the personal experience of these people. So that's generally where their base of support, what we know about it. Now the question is, how is that base of support going to translate into a democratic Egypt? Well, we now know that they're not the only viable alternative to Mubarak, right? It's not the brothers who got those protesters out there. It was Google, it was Facebook. It was a lot of other groups involved in it. So that part of their message doesn't seem to be there. There are some people who supported them because they were seen as the only viable group. We should expect them to move away. If there's an Egyptian government that provides better for its people, that provides services and opportunities for people, maybe those people that currently rely on those social services from the Islamic movement's parallel Islamic sector, maybe they'll be less supportive of the group over time. So what I'm saying is there are very good empirical and theoretical reasons to think that the support for the Muslim Brothers under authoritarianism isn't going to translate into support for them in a democratic Egypt. We also have other cases of countries that had Islamic movements under authoritarianism that made a transition to democracy. You do have electoral democracies in the Muslim world, just not in the Middle East. Indonesia is a good example. the Islamic movements, plural, there's many parties there, get like 10 to 15% of the vote. After the transition to democracy, their numbers don't go up. Same with Malaysia. So there's good reasons to think that the Muslim Brothers aren't going to come to power. And they're not going to run out into the streets and seize power. Come on. The Egyptian military is 400,000 people. It's not going to happen. The military regime is not breaking down in Egypt. Okay, so that's a little bit about the Muslim Brothers. Who's Omar Suleiman? I was going to show you some pictures. He's now the vice president and effectively the de facto president of Egypt. Omar Suleiman, he came up through the army. He participated in the 67 and 73 wars. I don't think we know that much about what he did. In the early 80s, he joined military intelligence. He became head of military intelligence during the first Persian Gulf War, where he developed close links to the Americans and to the other coalition partners. 1993, he becomes head of EGID, Egyptian intelligence, the Mukhabarat. And he became very close to Mubarak after he effectively saved Mubarak's life in 1995. In 1995, Mubarak takes a trip to the capital of Ethiopia. The Ethiopian government gives him a limousine to take him from the airport to the city. Omar Suleiman says, no, you can't ride in that limousine. It's unarmored. I have a special armored vehicle I brought down. Mubarak argued with him and said, no, it'll be an insult to the Ethiopians. And Omar Suleiman said, I insist. Good call on his part, because there was an assassination attempt where 11 Islamic Jihad, I think, shot up the car, the limousine, and obviously didn't get him. So he's been Mubarak's favorite since that point. He's been extremely important for the Americans. Right now, there's people whispering into Obama's ear that Omar Suleiman is the single most important person in the Arab world in the ongoing GWAT, the Global War on Terror. There's people still use the word GWAT. It's not a word, acronym. So because he's been very helpful in renditions, extremely helpful in renditions, if you know what I mean. So he's not a Democrat. He doesn't like the Muslim Brothers in any way, shape, or form. He doesn't like Islamism in any time. And actually, I should say, going over time, but. So to retaliate for that assassination attempt against Mubarak in 1995, how did the Egyptian government, Mubarak, led by Omar Suleiman, respond? Well, there's a great chapter in this book called The Looming Tower, a chapter called The Boy Spies. And you'll remember it if you've read it, because Omar Suleiman, his Mubarak, ended up picking up a 13-year-old boy who was the son of a member of Egyptian Islamic Jihad. Sodomized him, filmed it, and then threatened to expose it to his parents and to other members of his community unless he helped. I think they got another boy, did the same thing to him, had these two kids try to plant some bombs to kill the leader of that group, who was a guy named Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was in refuge in Sudan at the time. Zawahiri found out about it and executed the two boys. That pissed off the leader of Sudan at the time, Hassan Tarabi, who said, you gotta get out. So they kick Islamic Jihad and Zawahiri out. He floats around, he goes to Bulgaria, it sounds like, for a little while, to Switzerland. He isn't able to find a refuge. He's being hunted by the Mukhabarat. So where does he go? He calls up his friend Osama bin Laden, moves him and whatever remnants of his organization are left to Afghanistan, and a year later they merge with Al-Qaeda. That's why the rank and file of Al-Qaeda are Egyptians. They come from this group. They're the ones who are hunted by Omar Suleiman. And those groups, Egyptian Islamic Jihad, the Egyptian Islamic group, they wanted to overthrow the un-Islamic state in Egypt, headed by Mubarak. They weren't able to do it. Why? Because that regime gets $1.5 billion a year from another country. That makes it too large, too powerful. And they determined, after losing that insurgency in the 80s and early 90s to the Egyptian regime, that their only chance of achieving their aims was to not target the close enemy, the near enemy. It's to target the far enemy, the United States of America. So the Middle East, lots of things are linked. But Omar Suleiman, I was going to show you a little clip where he's being interviewed by Christiane Amanpour, where he talks about that the protesters who are out there, he says, this is the Islamic current. And it's not really their ideas. She asks him about democracy. Do you think these youths of Egypt in the Middle East who are using Facebook and the internet, that they want democracy? And he says, this idea doesn't come from them. It comes from abroad. She asks him, are you a Democrat? Do you believe in democracy? He's like, yes, we all believe in democracy. The question is when. When is it appropriate for Egypt? It's appropriate when we have a democratic culture. And the people, the protesters, need to understand that we've done all we can. She asks, what do you say to the protesters? I say, go home. Understand that Mubarak is not leaving, that we've achieved all that we can in this short period of time. You'll have a new president in a couple months and you can achieve more then. But for now, go home. Go to work. Bring back the tourists. That's his message, right? He's our guy. What are the demands of the protesters? And then I'll go home. So there's a large sign that hangs now in Tahrir Square. It says, "We want one, the president's downfall." Well, Mubarak hasn't left. There are rumors that he's going to go to Germany for an extended health check. I think to treat the persistent pain in his Tahrir. He hasn't left. He's the deep. Come on, that was a good one. He's no longer calling the shots, right? The second thing they wanted was an end to the fraudulent lower and upper houses of parliament. Neither of them have been recalled. There's no evidence that they're going to be. In fact, it sounds like under the Constitution that they can't be. Third, they want the immediate end of the state of emergency. That hasn't happened. And even if it does, it can always be brought right back. Four, they want the formation of a unified national transitional government. Christian Amanpour went on television the other day and said, for the first time ever, the Muslim Brothers are sitting down and talking with the vice president. Golly gee whiz. Nothing's happened. There have been tiny, small little concessions from the government basically saying that they'll consider looking at something, trying to get the protesters to go home, trying to split the opposition. And their game is basically one of attrition and waiting them out. The protesters want an elected parliament that undertakes constitutional amendments for the holding of presidential elections. That hasn't happened. Mubarak said that he will appoint his own committee to think about it. And the reason they're doing that is because the Constitution says that all candidates for the presidency have to come from existing parties that have so many seats and have to have served in leadership positions within that party for the previous years. Well, his boy, quite literally boy, Gamal, was the guy who had those criteria. Now that he's been run out of town and his supporters in the NDP have been run out of town by another faction, the NDP, they got to find another guy. So they'll amend the Constitution, but only so their handpicked guy can then run for president. Third, immediate trials for those responsible for the murder of the martyrs of the revolution hasn't happened. Swift trials for the corrupt and of the fortunes of the nation. That certainly hasn't happened. Nothing's changed. Anderson Cooper's left. Christian Amanpour's left. CNN and Fox News have moved on to the next cycle in the news. 16 days in, nothing has really changed, except for those protesters who are out there in the square, whose numbers seem to be growing. The regime knows exactly who they are. This is existential for them. This isn't go home tomorrow, get back about your life. It's go home tomorrow, and a month from now, somebody knocks on your door. You're walking home from your university 3 months from now, and a car pulls up next to you. Even if you don't disappear into some black hole somewhere, you're blacklisted across the board with every government agency. So it's really tempting. It's been exciting. We're watching it. We want to know if it's going to happen in Libya next week, if it's going to go to Jordan. Egypt is still where everybody's watching, and the story isn't over. Nothing's changed yet. And I want to end by reading one thing to you, and I want you guys to guess who said these words. I do have an unyielding belief that all people yearn for certain things, the ability to speak your mind and have a say in how you are governed, confidence in the rule of law, in the equal administration of justice, government that is transparent and doesn't steal from the people, the freedom to live as you choose. These are not just American ideals. They are human rights, and that is why we will support them everywhere. Who said those words? Where did he say them? In Cairo. Okay.
Hey, thanks. I'm here not because I'm a specialist on Egypt like our two panelists of the region, but rather because I work on two issues that are quite relevant to what is going on in Egypt. And the first is cross-national waves of popular protest against authoritarian rule. And the second is transitions from authoritarian to democratic rule. What I'd like to do is divide my comments into addressing three questions. The first question is, why Egypt? Obviously, a lot of people did not see this coming, including most members of the administration, but a variety of other people. The second question is, how should the U.S. respond to the protests? And the third is democracy a future for Egypt? on why Egypt. Actually, it's really striking what a textbook case Egypt is for these kinds of protests. And let me just highlight a couple of factors that come into play. One is, of course, the Tunisian precedent. What was important about Tunisia is that it said, this is the way you challenge authoritarian leaders, and this is the way it works. So they had both success and a model. And so that's perfect for demonstration effects. Secondly, they had dress rehearsals. Long history in Egypt of contentious politics, including strikes, protests. Very interesting how many different segments of society, how many geographical locations this history. And let me just say here in parentheses, there's no necessary correlation between how authoritarian a regime is and how much contentious politics you have. We often assume that they're correlated, they're often not. Third, you have a long-serving authoritarian leader and an approaching election. This is very important for providing a focal point for protesters, and it also loosens up the leader's patronage networks. The people who are allied with him are looking around for new allies since they can tell that he is on his way out. Fourth, Egypt has an extraordinarily strong national identity and well-established boundaries. That overrides important cleavages among opposition groups, and it can, as it did, for example, the classic case here is the Polish case, can facilitate a marriage between a liberal and a national political agenda. Finally, Egypt had mixed messages from major external actors in terms of regime preferences. For example, yes, the U.S. was allied with Mubarak, but they pressed him on the issue of electoral competition, and they provided substantial democracy assistance. They were speaking out of both sides of their mouth in terms of relationship with the regime. So what I see in the Egyptian case are all the ingredients you need for large-scale and prolonged mobilization. One, a positive precedent in the neighborhood. That is to say, the Tunisian example, anger, really phenomenal resources, including optimism, a ripened opposition and civil society development, and finally, expanded opportunities for political change. Also striking in the Egyptian case, they arrived, and this is in direct contrast, for example, to Algeria, which had minor protests right after the Tunisian developments. They arrived at a very, very quickly at a common political agenda. He's finished, to use the language as they are, to use the language that the Serbian opposition used in order to defeat Milosevic in 2000. Okay, second issue, the United States. This is far from the first time that the United States has been in an awkward position of being closely allied with an authoritarian leader who has significant portions of his population demanding his departure. The examples I think of immediately, Suharto of Indonesia, Marcos of the Philippines, and the Shah of Iran. In all of these cases, the U.S. was caught by surprise, it feared chaos, and was very slow to distance itself from the embattled leader and to side with popular protests on the streets. In my view, the problem with the U.S. reaction to what is now more than 2 weeks of protests, and as David mentioned, growing in size, not shrinking, is that one, like Mubarak, the United States has been extremely slow to recognize. The protests are massive. These people are not going home. They're converging around the demand that Mubarak leave, and that Mubarak, for that, all those reasons, has to go. Secondly, Iran in 1978 through 1979, which seems to be for mysterious reasons to me, although I think I can probably come up with some hypotheses, the analogy that the administration seems to be clinging to is in fact very dissimilar with the current situation in Egypt. Whereas there do seem to be some parallels between Egypt on the one hand and, for example, Indonesia and the fall of Suharto on the other. Three, the sharp break, not negotiated break through Suleiman, the sharp break with authoritarian rule in both Indonesia and the Philippines led in both cases to a successful transition to democracy. So, the negotiated transition is not the only way to go or necessarily the preferable way to go. Let me talk now briefly about a final issue, and that is the prospects for a transition to democracy. Obviously, it's far too early to tell. As David said, there's not been a lot of headway on a whole variety of issues, although I think a lot of things have changed. It's just that there's a slow response to the changes. But I think it's too early to tell about democracy. But what I'd like to do is to challenge some common arguments that are floating around that say, in effect, that democracy is an unlikely outcome in the Egyptian case. One, let me remind you, many successful transitions to democracy began with large-scale popular protests. And they included the young, the older opposition, variable class groups in general. What examples? South Korea, Philippines, the very case that started the third wave of democratization, Portugal, 1974, Czechoslovakia, East Germany. I can create quite a long list. All of these started with massive popular protests. Secondly, many of the popular mobilization cases that had democratic outcomes had, in fact, no obvious opposition leader or a united or well-organized opposition. Hungary didn't, East Germany didn't, Bulgaria didn't. I can name other cases. Third, regime-founding elections, even when they're held quickly, that is, the first elections after the transition, regime-founding elections, even when they're held quickly, can support democratic change. This is even the case when political parties are weak and hardly in evidence and hardly developed. The protests, for example, in Egypt, could serve as the basis for the formation of a broad united front based on key values, such as an end to authoritarianism and the creation of a democratic system. The second election, the one that follows that, then becomes the one that allows for the formation of political parties and interest-based conflicts among political parties. One example, Poland, 1989 through 1990. This is exactly the dynamic we saw there. Another point, many of the successful cases of transition from democracy to dictatorship took place in countries that had no democratic history and thus no institutions available to recycle to support democratic change. The entire post-communist region could be described that way, and we have a number of successful cases. This is different, of course, from the re-democratization processes that you saw in Latin America. Finally, many, again, of the countries that have had successful transitions were poor, they had small middle classes, a history of military intervention in politics, and demographics skewed towards the young. Philippines, Indonesia, we can come up with some other examples. Thus, what I'm trying to argue here is that none of the factors that have been trotted out to doubt, and trotted out by the administration as well, have been trotted out to doubt Egypt's case for democracy are in fact very good arguments if you look at the record of the last 35 years of transitions from dictatorship to democracy. In addition, and here I think this is also really important, there are very few cases over the past 35 years since this big wave of democratic transitions began. There are very few cases of popular mobilizations against authoritarian rule that ended up in chaos, that ended up with, for example, new authoritarian governments. Either they end up with democracy or they end up with regimes that straddle dictatorship and democracy, and this becomes the foundation for a subsequent transition. Now, finally, and I'll stop here, if we look at the subset of cases that most resemble the Egyptian situation, and I would say some kind of composite of Poland, 1989, Indonesia, and Serbia, 2000, Indonesia, 1998, we can identify a dynamic that seems to support a democratic outcome. First, breakage. The incumbent must go to free authoritarian allies to switch their goals and switch their allies and to validate the opposition's actions and support them. Second, a rapid formation of a broadly inclusive interim government that takes on the responsibility of crafting some transitional rules of the game and setting the date and the rules for the first competitive elections. And three, elections held within a year after the formation of this provisional government. Following the elections, some kind of group within the parliament can hold responsibility for redrafting the constitution. Thanks.
Hi everyone, I'm Erin Zillman. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Cornell International Affairs Review. First, can we give another round of applause for our speakers? What we're going to do is maybe take a few questions, direct them to the professors, and then we'll address those questions. So one, two, three. Go ahead. Yes. And next to you, is there a question?
I have a couple questions, but all of them are related. First is more straightforward.
Can you speak up? Sorry.
Is Egypt still in control of the Suez Canal? I don't know if you can answer that right now. But based off that question, regardless of yes or no, what do you think of the possibility that Israel might attempt to push for control of the canal again, reminiscent of the Suez Canal crisis in the 1957,
1957,
and expand
territory to the Egyptian
land again.
Can we stop here?
Sure.
And then, yeah,
okay.
It's going to get out of hand.
That's fine.
You want me to start with that?
Sure.
Well, I'll start with the last one. It's actually an easier question to answer. Yes, Egypt is still in control of the Suez Canal. However, recently I just heard that some of the people who are working in the Suez Canal are calling on strikes. So there might be some strikes going on, but at this point, it doesn't look like it's going to interfere with the navigation. But we still have to wait and see. Second question: no, that would be. I mean, in 2011, the dynamics and the geopolitical dynamics just would not allow this. And so definitively, I would say no. And if it does, yeah, I mean. Chaos would, I mean, I can't even describe the chaos that would go on. I mean, so, and it would be just regional and even global chaos, and some of, which I can't even, it's beyond my qualifications
I'm
to even describe
to
this.
The
so.
Gates of hell will open.
Yes, that would be the best way
he
to
He says
say
that all
it,
the
so.
Time, though.
I'll take a stab at the first question, and then I'll give it to David. First of all, I think it's
the...
Oh, the first question is the Mubarak is what will it take for Mubarak to step down? I think that's the wrong question. Why? Because I think Mubarak is irrelevant at this point. I think he's done. You know, I think the person that we should talk about is Omar Suleiman. He's in control. Mubarak knows that. Omar Suleiman knows that. I think the administration knows that, and that's the key point. Whether Mubarak leaves in September, which I doubt, which is what he wants to do, sort of finish his term, or whether he leaves earlier is a matter of semantics. And the key is right now is Omar Suleiman. He is essentially in control of Egypt at the moment, or trying to take control of Egypt at the moment. We can guess at different scenarios, really, but we won't really know a definitive answer. I think if the demonstrations continue on at this pace, and I think the biggest demonstrations took place actually yesterday, as far as numerically speaking, and there are plans for the following Friday to have even bigger demonstrations. Don't forget that this has economic implications. And so aside from the military and other forces that can actually possibly have a coup and a counter coup and even get Suleiman out of power, which is a possibility, not likely after that shift that happened at the top, but we are sure that there are people within the military circles, at least some of the lower ranks, who are discussing this at the moment for sure. I mean, we have no way of knowing, I think that the whole economic picture and the fact that people are continuing to be mobilized and he cannot use a force at the moment. If I were a betting man, I'd say that it is possible, certainly within the next month or so, for even Suleiman to be toppled. I wouldn't have said this 3 days ago because it seemed like the demonstrations were going down. So that picture changes really day to day, and it's very, very hard to predict. Whether the economic picture will force some military action against them and sort of a type of counter coup at the top which would allow change or not, I don't know. But there are different scenarios.
I cannot imagine a scenario in which Israel invades the Sinai and takes the Suez Canal. I think if Netanyahu proposed it, Ehud Barak would pull away from the cabinet. I think every general and the chief of all the generals advising Netanyahu would say no way, and it would be a disaster for strategic disaster for Israel, and I think all the Israeli planners understand that. So I think with the issue of Mubarak stepping down, here's what I think is a critical thing. What's the role of the Egyptian constitution? If Mubarak steps down, who becomes the president of Egypt? Not Omar Suleiman, the Speaker of the House, right? Who's an NDP lackey. So it gets really complicated. So Omar Suleiman suddenly is not the president in any way, shape, or form. And it becomes even more complicated because only an elected president can disband parliament and call for new parliamentary elections. So if Mubarak steps down, Omar Suleiman is now number two. The current Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq isn't even on the radar screen anymore. A member from the party, not the military, is now the president of the country. Okay, military is now wondering what's going on. It also constrains what you can do. It means you have to go ahead with a presidential election, not with a parliamentary election. What's the alternative? Mubarak steps down and we forget about the constitution completely. Well, then the whole Pandora's box has been opened up. What are the rules in which you can run for president? When do you have presidential elections? When do you have parliamentary elections? Remember, a constitution is just a piece of paper, right? It's just words. There's a number of countries that adopted the US Constitution almost word for word. What matters are those beliefs and expectations that other actors will follow those rules. And right now, everyone's pretending like that Egyptian constitution is the framework determining the different paths that the country could go down. If Mubarak steps down, it suddenly becomes very complicated. And that's a great excuse for him to stay there. But it's also a realistic way that I think a lot of, and they're having debates now. Do you amend the constitution just enough to change the rules for the presidency? Do you also at the same time change the rules over who becomes the president in the interim period? Do you try to appoint an interim set of leaders, of which Omar Suleiman would be one, maybe some opposition people would be one? Some people have suggested, let's just wipe the constitution away and start from scratch. Well, that took a long time in Iraq to get a constitution nailed down. And again, Mubarak is one guy. We shouldn't think of him as just, he's the tip of the iceberg. And when I say iceberg, I mean tens of thousands of entrenched bureaucrats and party members who sit atop their own little fiefdoms of patronage, and they have a stamp. And they stamp this piece of paper and take a $100 bribe for stamping that piece of paper. The Egyptians who are out there in Tahrir Square want that system and want promise of a reform in that system. Cutting off the head, the guy's 83 years old. He's not gonna be around for another term anyways. I mean, him going is one thing. This is their chance to really have change. And the question is, how deep is that change going to go? Is this going to be de-Ba'athification, literally, of the NDP or not? So those are the sort of issues people are talking about. And the Constitution's role, I think, in guiding the process is right now the big impediment to Mubarak saying adios.
An asterisk to what David just said before we take other questions. That whole rumor of Mubarak going to Germany, I don't know if it's true or not, that's actually a way for Soleimani to take over. Because constitutionally, if the president is incapacitated or sick, then the vice president can take over and so forth. So that's a possibility that would be encouraged by Suleiman, but we have no way of knowing. But I do not think that the demonstrators will be satisfied with Suleiman as president.
Yes.
Professor Patel, you mentioned rendition. Could you please clarify what is an extraordinary rendition? Why is it so important to American interests? And from a naive point of view, you could say, well, they could send in a special force, get the records, no worries, and we could just move the whole thing like we did with Mar over to Syria. Why is that a deep interest?
Do you want to take other questions, too?
One more.
Yes, so I'm trying to figure out what the role of US policy could be kind of here, because it seems to me that there's three pillars on which for the power of Mubarak, and I'm not an Egypt specialist. It's like, you know, the society in general, which right now is in protest, is in danger. The second part is the military and the security system, which is still intact. The third one is the US and the international allies, which, you know, we fund the military, etc. So does it matter what Obama says and what we do, you know? If, you know, counterfactually, if Obama and the U.S. policy makers say, we do not support your government anymore, we threaten that we're going to cut the $1.5 billion we pay for your military, etc., and the military who has been trained here, you know, we threaten any further collaboration, how much will this undermine kind of the other pillar, the military pillar of the regime?
So I usually think adjectives aren't useful, and especially when you talk about extraordinary renditions. They're not really extraordinary anymore. In fact, they're pretty common. So there's a lot of... Egypt has been extremely cooperative with the United States in allowing other countries to snatch Egyptian citizens, and from what we hear, oftentimes citizens of other Arab countries, off streets of various European capitals and off various purported battlefields, and send them back to Egypt. And sometimes you hear, and again, these are stories you hear, sometimes en route on the boat, the CIA gets to interrogate them, or if they end up in Egypt, U.S. intelligence agencies are able just to give a list of questions to the Egyptians, and then they're provided answers to those questions from the screaming mouth of the person who was brought back. So they've been extremely, and this is Omar Suleiman's organization, the Mukhabarat, that's the point organization on this. They've been extremely cooperative. And to be blunt, the Egyptian intelligence agencies are the best in the world in fighting Islamic radicalism. They have a lot of experience through the 80s and 90s against Egyptian Islamic Jihad and the Gamma. They penetrated these organizations, and if anybody has connections and is really knowing what's going on inside groups in Afghanistan, it's from the Arab world, it'll probably be the Egyptian intelligence. So he's extremely important to it. But we hear a lot of stories about the renditions that have gone on. You don't know how many of them are true. There's now some leaked sources that provide some information that you can learn some more about this if you're interested. But I don't have any special information about.
Did you want to take that?
I'll say a little bit about U.S. foreign policy. I mean, the U.S. is walking a difficult line because, on the one hand, you have to respect sovereignty and act like you are respecting sovereignty, and the sovereignty is in the hands of the Egyptian people. You know, on the other hand, they're worried about, you know, they feel like they have to take a stand on this, and unfortunately they often take the wrong stand on it. But I think the most important thing the U.S. could do is to work through its military-to-military contacts. I mean, one of the things that David was actually saying the other day that I thought was a really good point when we were talking about this is that how chaotic will it get given the military? Not very. There's a limit to what can possibly happen here. And because of this very professional, very large, very effective military. So I think that what the U.S. should do is, among other things, they have kind of imagined this so far, and I think it's just really wrong-headed, as a Spanish transition. But as I pointed out to some people, in the Spanish transition is famous because what they did is that there was a very important figure that had a foot in the authoritarian camp that served as a transitional leader, Suarez. Well, Franco died. That really made a difference, you know. And Suarez, you know, was in a position to say, do I think about the past and all these linkages and all these patronage networks, or do I think about the future of the regime? And he had an incentive to do the future of the regime. Suleiman has no incentive to do that. And I think that is a really bad situation because he can just hold on to the old regime, reassure the usual networks, et cetera. So in that particular narrow sense, I obviously think the U.S. should not be backing Suleiman because you don't have the right sequence. You make the regime break, and then you talk about a transitional leader. You don't talk about a transitional leader before the regime break because that person will not be a transitional leader. Let me just say that I think the authoritarians can promote a democratic agenda. That can happen if they have no reason to hold on to authoritarianism, and they're shopping around for other things to do. And that's what I think is the real problem in U.S. policy now.
I'm going to stand so everybody could hear me. I would like to go on a different level of the question, realities. That is the paradigm shift in understanding the relationship of so-called Islamic movement or the pretend of having an Islamic movement versus democracy. I was happy to hear David deconstructing this myth of this paradigm. My question is now, what message are we to send to the policymakers in this country specifically of how they can shift that paradigm in their thinking of dealing with Egypt? Thank you.
Thanks. And was there a hand over there?
Yeah, I had kind of two related questions about the role and the influence of the media. First of all, does anyone take state television in Egypt seriously? How many people were dependent on that for their main source of news in Egypt? And also, in from the U.S. policy perspective, how much has the Obama administration been influenced by the reporting?
I'll take the second question, and I'll leave the first one to David. I've been watching closely, actually, Egyptian state television, and it's hard to gauge how many people really take it seriously. I think most are already used to looking at other media sources, Al Jazeera, but many others as well. Just to give you an example of what Egyptian television did, first of all, from the very beginning, it was a campaign of lies from the very beginning. You would have cameras, either older footage or focus on a different part of Cairo showing that there's order about, while at the same time there's millions of demonstrators in the streets. You'd have rumors and have people come on the TV spreading rumors. One of my favorites, which was talked about on national television, was that this movement is caused by outsiders. And outsiders are, and I quote here, the U.S., Iran, Hezbollah, and Israel.
And they
working
work together
in Qatar
on this project.
To
right?
start, yeah. So another one is that all of those protesters are being paid around $50,000 each. I'm not a mathematician, but multiply just a million by 50,000, 50 billion or more, I don't know, I'm a historian. And my favorite, the protesters have been using a lot of this material to make fun of the state television, the regime, almost immediately with some of their signs. Another of my favorite is that they're all, in addition to the $50,000, are being fed Kentucky Fried Chicken. So, again, imagine the line was pretty long. So there is a Kentucky Fried Chicken right off of Tahrir Square, but I doubt it has the capacity to feed over a million people. But when David mentioned Omar Suleiman talking with Cristiano Amanpour, he also interviewed a few times. His first interview on state television in Egypt, just to give you a sense of his personality and how almost impossible for him to really shift tracks to sort of a democratic track. I don't believe it. And the commentator was sort of setting him up with nice questions, and he was responding back. The first was that people who are demonstrating and are unpatriotic, and those who are calling for Mubarak's ousters are not real Egyptians, because Mubarak is the father of all Egyptians. That was definitely one of my favorites. And in addition to this, the commentator asked him, "So how do you propose to get them out there by force?" His first response was like, "No, I will talk to their parents." Yeah. I mean, just think about it. He really believes, I mean, he almost believes this. I mean, there is this sense of just infantilizing the whole movement, looking at it as completely insignificant, mm-hmm. infantilizing the Egyptian people as a whole, as subjects. And that transition from subject to citizen hasn't really occurred, apparently. And so how do you deal with a person like this and make him the president of Egypt? I doubt very much that transition will ever take place. What will happen, and this is my prediction, if it does take place and somehow the protesters begin to leave Tahrir Square, slowly but surely you're going to have what David alluded to, arrests, people being snatched. There's already a long list of the key demonstrators, probably in the thousands, with their names and addresses, and the regime knows exactly where they are. And as soon as international attention is moved away, they will be arrested and disappear somewhere in the desert camps. That's my opinion. Can't remember what was the other question.
Oh, on
I can't either.
No, on regime, the U.S.
Islamic
regime
and Islam versus democracy.
Oh, yes.
So if you guys haven't seen this interview by Wael Gugel, they call him now, watch it. I think it did change a lot of attitudes. You can get it on New York Times, and especially, it's long, it's like 30 minutes, but especially watch the last two segments where he's talking about this. And he responds to some of these things, and he talks about, he was the guy that started the Facebook site that seems to have gotten it rolling. And he's so Egyptian. He's just, his way of talking, the way he interacts. He was so emotional when talking about being called a traitor. And he talks about what happened when the intelligence agencies picked him up. They really believe that he was being pushed by foreign agitators, and he responds to this. And I think I don't know if it was a game changer, but clearly there's tens of thousands of people who've joined the protest in the last day because of him and because of his speech, and especially when he gets emotional and starts crying when he sees the images for the first time of people who had died. We never wanted this. This is because of people who are in power and refuse to go. It's extremely powerful. And I think everyone in Egypt has seen that now and is talking about it. It's fantastic. And he's the man of the hour now. What's amazing right now is you can follow him on Twitter. He tweets in English. He's like, I'm trying to get to Tahrir. There's a blockage in front of me. As this is going on, guys, you can follow this in real time. There are dozens of people in Tahrir Square right now tweeting in English, telling you what's happening, telling you on Twitter, go to this end of Tahrir Square. The military's moving. You can follow it in real time. You can get a sense of the confusion of what a revolutionary experience is like. You can follow it on blogs and Facebook, live from the square. It's not voyeurism. It's really understanding how these things unfold and the uncertainty about what it must be like to be there right now. And you see the euphoria and the fear that the people in the square have. So how can the U.S. regime come to a better administration come to a better understanding of Islamists and their future role? Well, the first thing is to listen to them, to talk to them. The United States government, as far as I understand, does not officially talk to Muslim brother groups anymore. They can. They probably do unofficially. I would talk to them, hear what they have to say. The Muslim Brothers of Egypt have an English website. Just Google Muslim Brothers or Ikhwan, and you'll find the English language website. And they make lots of statements up there about what they believe in. And they're very blunt. They keep going in Al Jazeera English, their leaders, over and over and over and over. And they say, we want to participate but not dominate. We will not run a candidate for president, full stop. We will back a secular candidate for president. The other thing the U.S. government can do is bring in advisors, and I got to say they brought in some really good Egypt experts who are talking to them about the Muslim Brothers. And the Muslim Brothers don't think in terms of years. They think in terms of decades. Yeah. They believe that history is on their side. They're very, very patient. They don't want to come to power tomorrow. In fact, many of them believe that it would be bad to come to power tomorrow because the Egyptian population has not internalized the need to return to Islamic values and morals. So now is not the time. Now, if you believe them, that they really do understand the way society should be governed, you know, let them participate. Let them try to get votes. And I think what you'll end up seeing is that, like I said in my talk, they're not going to have as much support as they have under authoritarianism. The reasons why people have supported them under authoritarianism isn't likely to translate into support in a democratic context. And don't get me wrong, they've said everything they can possibly say to try to convince us that they believe in electoral democracy. And they probably do. But they are not a pluralist organization. They are not a secular organization, full stop, and they're not going to be. They have a very conservative vision of how they think society should be structured. They've been very unclear on politically what they want, because I don't think internally they know, for a number of reasons, what ultimately their ideal political arrangement is. But they do want a much more conservative Egyptian society. And I think there's dispute within the organization over what's the proper role of the state in commanding right and forbidding wrong. And I think us not talking to them and pushing them on the sidelines really disempowers those voices within the organization that want to take a much more moderate line in the political process.
Yeah. I think it's important to add here, in terms of parties that I have seen making this transition from being an authoritarian to a democratic regime, they usually split. They usually divide. They usually have very different views within one another, because the tasks that they face as competing for political power is a very different set of tasks than surviving in a difficult authoritarian environment. It's a completely different set of concerns, completely different. So I suspect that not unlike, frankly, Solidarity and Poland, they will split. And they will divide, and some of them will not want to be part of that political process, and they will disagree on electoral tactics, you name it. So one of the things that's a problem, I think, so often, and when the U.S. views this kind of thing, it tends to assume that the people that you are worried about are much more cohesive than they actually are, and the people that you support are much more divided than they actually are. I mean, you see this over and over again, and when the U.S. confronts certain kinds of politically difficult situations. And I think they're doing it again.
Oh, go ahead.
I'll just add a few words to this. I mean, They're already a moderate organization, the Muslim Brotherhood. In the 1970s, for example, they renounced violence. And the way to make them even more moderate is to have them participate in the system. And not by marginalizing them. That's not going to work, and that's really going to be counterproductive. To give you an example here, because a lot of people are thinking of this as sort of something that is happening far away to the other. They're very similar as far as their demographic appeal in Egypt to the Christian right in the United States. And so imagine if a foreign power or someone tells you, well, people who are part of the Christian right, religious conservatives in this country, cannot vote and cannot hold office. That makes absolutely no sense. And if you're going to have a true democracy, and you're going to have to include their voices as part of the system. And that's really the only way that it's going to be more stable, and that will provide true stability in the long term. So I'm as secularist as it can be, but nonetheless, I think that's the way to do it.
The other thing I think it's important to remind people in the U.S. administration is somebody from D.C. asked me the other day, how can we allow the Egyptians to have democracy if we don't know if they're going to use that responsibly? And I just take a deep breath. Say om, and then try to explain to them why that's the wrong way to think about it, and how we need to see Egypt as a group of people and not through a geostrategic prism.
I do want to say, we keep going on this, but I do want to say it's important to recognize that there are differences of opinion within the administration, and that they are in a big search, as I heard from several people today in the NSC. They are looking for some kind of guidelines, especially analogies, of how to think about this. And, you know, I'm of the Vietnam generation, and we went through Munich, right? We unfortunately learned very much the hard way that when decision makers choose the wrong historical analogy, we're in deep trouble. You know, that the Mekong Delta is not in San Francisco, in fact, et cetera. And they are now searching for that. Because they're realizing, they're nervous about choices they've made and arguments, and so I don't want to over-homogenize the administration and its position on these questions, because I think they're really at a loss about where to go next, and there are many voices in the process.
So I just want to thank, unfortunately, Professor Bontes has to leave, but can we once again thank her for attending?
Thank you.